This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with a company that turns unused aircraft parts into high-end furniture and art designs. In the news, Pratt & Whitney's new hypersonic engine project, the Air Force Research Laboratory autonomous Skyborg aircraft to be based on the Boeing Loyal Wingman, Boeing criticizes the A321 XLR fuselage tank, Qantas offers mystery flights, and the Southwest Airlines Medical Transportation Grant Program provided $3 million worth of free flights. We also have a giveaway that any AvGeek will want to pay attention to, as well as a discount code. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 644 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year. And of course, he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
Max, hello, how you doing? This is going to be a fun, fun topic. I am looking forward to this.
Yeah, this is going to be a good one. I have a feeling in my bones. And speaking of feelings in my, I don't know what that transition is, but also with us is Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari.
Greetings to all the planes in the air and geeks within the sound of my voice. Yeah. Glad to be with you tonight.
And did you get that right? I thought that he was our large reporter, not large, you know, reporter at large.
He's our large reporter at large. Exactly. Let's put it that way. David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian, is off this week. I think he has an event at the museum, at the American Helicopter Museum, so he's not able to join us. But we have a great guest this episode. That's Dave Hall. Now, he's the co-founder and owner of Moto Art LLC, and he's the founder and owner of Moto Art Plane Tags. Dave began his career working at his father's fuel storage tank business, which plays later in his career, and he later moved on to marketing and selling high-end architectural signage for amusement parks and sports arenas. Well, in 2001, Dave and his former colleague Donovan Fell began creating sculptures out of vintage World War II propellers. So these sculptures were so popular that the two of them formed a partnership and created Moto Art LLC to produce high-end aviation-inspired furniture art and art designs, but get this, constructed from genuine aircraft parts. Now, Moto Art has created over 100 limited edition custom designs for both private and Fortune 500 clients. And then in 2016, Dave created Plane Tags. Now, these are collectible 3-inch oval-shaped luggage tags that are made from authentic aircraft skin. Each plane tag is laser etched with the aircraft's schematic and serial and tail number and is attached to a baseball-type trading card containing the history of the aircraft. Fascinating. So, Dave, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're immersed in all this aviation stuff, but I understand that you've never flown an airplane and you don't have a pilot's license.
No. You know, I like to say, what little boy doesn't fly around his room with his arms out pretending that he's flying? And I think I'm that kind of kid where I grew up just with the fascination of flight. And I have a true admiration of everyone who does fly. But I'm kind of the guy who enjoys the back seat and just be able to collect some of this old aircraft before seeing it disappear. And so that's where I found my passion.
Absolutely. I understand that as well. I'm a back of the plane kind of guy as well. So it's you and me versus Launchpad and Max Trescott, the two pilots and on the show tonight. But I think we'll hold our own against those guys, I'm sure. All right. First, we've got some aviation news from the past week. Are you guys all ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready deep in the heart of...
Our first story comes from Aviation Week, by Guy Norris and Steve Trimble. This is Pratt & Whitney makes hypersonic revival as Pentagon pushes reuse. Well, Guy and Steve report that Pratt & Whitney has a secret development program to develop a low-cost, reusable hypersonic propulsion system, and that this capability is high on the priority of the U.S. Department of Defense. Now, the program is called Metacomet, and you might wonder, Metacomet, where does that come from? Well, it's the name of a Wampanoag chief. It's also the name of a 62-mile trail in central Connecticut, one I've hiked on many, many times. So this is Project Metacomet. Now, Pratt, of course, has experience with the J-58 engine that was developed for the Lockheed SR-71. And in that engine, the J-58, there's a transition from a turbojet to a turbo ramjet. That's, of course, when it diverts air from the compressor directly into the afterburner. Now, this Project Metacomet is underdeveloped by Pratt & Whitney's Gatorworks division. That's right, Gatorworks division. It's a prototyping division in Florida. It's sort of like Skunkworks, but it's in Florida, so it's Gatorworks, of course. And that hasn't been around that long, formed in 2018. You know, we always get excited by things that go fast, and we're excited to see a program like this, I think.
And we can't show you the video right now, but there's two guys standing behind Max Flight right now with suits, dark glasses, and earbuds in, and they've just taken the press release from him, and they've said, good, now don't say anything more about it. Remember what you've been. And the two guys from Pratt & Whitney are walking out. Okay.
There we go. Yeah, there isn't too much more we really can say.
And that's because we know all the details, but we're just not at liberty to share them?
Well, Max is.
Well, there is something that the that Gatorworks says. The director, the senior director of Gatorworks, David Stagney, who commented, the faster you go, the larger the propulsion system is relative to the vehicle and how much payload and fuel you can actually fit in. He says, so we've spent a lot of time going back to the fundamentals and thinking about how to solve that problem differently. We know the Air Force wants to go really fast. They also want to have some very low-cost solutions and to be able to have a large quantity of vehicles.
But so in other words, they want it all.
They want everything. That's right. Fast and cheap.
And quick, of course. Let's give it to us tomorrow.
So what are the applications for this? I mean, what are the specific applications? Well, we don't know. But Stagney says that the AFRL, the Air Force Research Laboratory, has a proposed demonstrator vehicle for a hypersonic air-breathing propulsion system. It's called Mayhem. That's the name of their project. And
what could go wrong with that?
Yeah, really. And so you know, this may be an application for that. Mayhem is a... it's a larger scale, it's expendable, air-breathing, hypersonic, multi-mission. The idea is that it can carry larger payloads over distances greater than what we see with current hypersonic capabilities. There's another little twist to this, and actually Aviation Week brings this up. The technology that is taking place down there in Gatorworks, Pratt has to be careful because Pratt & Whitney formerly owned the Rocketdyne unit, which develops scramjets as well as rocket engines. But Pratt sold that off a few years ago, actually in 2005. Yes, I think in 2005. So, 2005 was when, was when Pratt bought Rocketjet from Boeing and then sold it to GenCorp in 2013, where it merged Aerojet with Aerojet to form Aerojet Rocketdyne. So Pratt has to be careful that they don't infringe upon any of the IP of their former unit. So they have to develop all new technology. But Rocketdyne has been around, seems like forever. Its history goes back to the 50s, actually, when it was spun off of North American Aviation. But, you know, it's an indicator of how long they've been around. Aerojet's website, URL, is rocket.com.
Nice if you can have it. Wow.
Yeah, or if you got it from the beginning. Yeah. All right. Well, Boeing's in the news also. This is from Reuters. Boeing to base U.S. Air Force prototype on Australian pilotless combat jet.
Yeah, so the aspect about this that I'm not clear on is Boeing obviously is going to be leveraging this fighter-like drone-type non-piloted aircraft from Australia. But who developed it? Was it an arm of Boeing in Australia, or was it a totally separate company? That's not clear to me.
It's Boeing's operation in Australia, but it's an Australian design and development. I think Australia can lay claim to this. It's called the Loyal Wingman, and the idea is it's a pretty good-sized drone that would accompany things like F-35s and aircraft like that, and provide additional capabilities. So what we're likely to see in the future is one kind of command aircraft, maybe like an F-35 with maybe a swarm of other unmanned aircraft that it can utilize in its mission.
And I think, one, the airplane, as a drone, it's about the size of an F-15, or maybe a little smaller. And what this opens up is we don't know, we could speculate all day long on what the doctrine of this stuff is going to be. And that's what I'm interested in. Is it going to be that a tanker goes up and these things fly for, 3 days on a mission set and just keep going and getting fuel. And then a different airplane comes up, a different manned fighter, like a F-15, what's a new one? EX, that's and the backseater. And he takes a wingman, one of the loyal drones with him to go out and do a mission, comes back, parks the drone again next to a tanker, and while he returns to base. There is so much doctrine that you can do with this that the Loyal Wingman program, we're not, holy cow, it's like giving somebody a ray gun and figuring out, okay, what's the doctrine for using this thing?
Yeah.
And I'm sure on the doctrine side, there's going to be a lot of, how long can this thing stay in the air if we just keep putting gas in it?
There are a lot of options, certainly. And I think there are ideas maybe about those kinds of missions, but, what will actually transpire is, I think, to be determined. The AFRL, the Air Force Research Laboratory that we just mentioned, is developing what's called a Skyborg autonomous aircraft. And the AFRL is contracted with Boeing, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, and Kratos Defense and Security Solution to develop these prototypes. And it looks like Boeing is going to be basing this bid, these prototypes, on this Australian Loyal Wingman aircraft. But this is all in the early development stage. But they are going to test some of this technology this summer in something called Orange Flag. You've heard of Red Flag, and there's this flag and that flag. Well, there's also an Orange Flag. And so the intent is to test some of this technology during that that event this summer.
And I think a lot of pilots sometimes have just kind of a knee-jerk reaction to, hey, we don't want our fighter jets being replaced with non-piloted aircraft. But I think what people may not realize is you can get so much performance out of an aircraft just because you've taken out all the things required to have a person, on board, flying it. You end up with a smaller flat plate area, so you're going to have less drag immediately because you can slim down the front of it, and you just can eliminate a lot of pieces of equipment related to controls and seating and windshield and all that kind of stuff, which means you can get a better performance aircraft. You can choose to put in more fuel so the thing will, go for, much longer. You could have a bigger payload of, weapons and things like that. You probably get higher speed out of it. So really, from a performance standpoint, this makes a heck of a lot of sense.
And a lot more G-loading. Because aircraft are limited by that little fleshy bag thing that's sitting in the front.
Right. And the autonomous aircraft are, in the end, going to be considered somewhat more expendable, I think. And you might send one of these out ahead, let's say, on a mission where you'd prefer to hold back the manned aircraft in order to, lower the risk.
Unless the aircraft get too smart and they say, no, you go out first.
And speculating, maybe, But what we've seen so far is the unmanned aircraft end up being so darn expensive that it's the same cost as buying a manned aircraft. So my question is based on this, who's funding versus who has the intellectual property? Is this Australia, the Royal Australian Air Force paying Boeing, or is this a joint initiative with an agreement that Boeing can share the technology back to us, you know, which is not covered in the article?
No, I think Boeing owns the IP here, but there could be other arrangements. I'm not positive. All right, well, let's talk about a commercial issue. Boeing and Airbus. Boeing labels new Airbus jet a, quote, potential hazard just days after being fined millions for safety oversights. Of course, Boeing and Airbus have been after each other in the, on the world stage for subsidies and so forth. And we don't have an article here, but I think I read the other day that the intent is to pause the tariffs that have been imposed on each other as a result of all that. But in the meantime, Boeing's got something to say about the Airbus A321. Now, the 321 has been really successful in the marketplace. In fact, over 2,000 are in service. I think American Airlines is the largest operator. And it's part of the A320 family, and it shares the same type rating. Well, what Airbus is been developing is the A321 XLR. Now, this can seat up to 244 passengers. It's got a range of 4,500 nautical miles. So in order to achieve that range, it needs more fuel. And you can only put so much fuel in the wing tanks and so forth. So Airbus's solution is to carry more fuel in a tank that is molded into the fuselage. So it's actually, it's internal. It's not like a conformal tank on the outside. It's in the shape of the fuselage. Now, Boeing has informed EASA, the European Union Safety Agency, that this design, quote, presents many potential hazards. EASA has already noted that the design maybe should be looked at. In fact, EASA has said, quote, an integral fuselage fuel tank exposed to an external fire, if not adequately protected, may not provide enough time for the passengers to safely evacuate the aircraft. So what's Boeing's long game here? Well, the A321 family in general and the XLR is, you know, encroaching into that middle of the market airplane that Boeing was going to develop and kind of isn't at the moment.
Well, haven't there been other Boeing aircraft with fuel tanks that are not in the wings? You know, for example, didn't the 747 have fuel tanks that were, you know, at the bottom of the fuselage? And for sure, I know that the 737 Boeing business jet, you can add extra tanks to those. And I'm thinking that those are, you know, in the fuselage as well, but I'm not 100% sure.
Right. The 747 has a tank in the wing box. In the center. In fact, that's where the problem was with TWA Flight 800, where that tank wasn't being used for that particular flight, and so there wasn't really any fuel in there. But of course, there's fumes in there, and the electrical spark is what initiated that explosion. So that led to a lot of regulatory changes in terms of safety for those kinds of tanks. Of course, you know, nothing's more dangerous than a gas tank that's empty, because the fumes are a lot more volatile than the liquid fuel. Yeah, so Boeing, of course, would like to see the A321 go away, because that's a big segment of the market that they would like to be in. So I think it's sort of a continuation in my mind of sort of the spats between Boeing and Airbus.
I agree. It's just, and I think also it's a little bit of Boeing being, hey, you're dragging a fine comb through all of our stuff. Let's see that same comb drag through them too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. From the Washington Post, Max Trescott, we seem to have a lot of interesting kinds of flights in this era of COVID, and you found another one.
Yes, certainly the airlines around the world have been very creative in coming up with ways to get passengers to sign up for new and novel kinds of trips that haven't existed in the past. The latest one here comes from Qantas, the Australia national carrier, and they have decided that they are launching three mystery flights to unspecified destinations, which I think is kind of fun and clever. So for, $500 and some for a coach ticket or about $1,200 for a business class ticket, you can sign up. By the way, this includes meals, drinks, plus the experience. And so they will take you to some destination that they won't tell you in advance. And then when you get there, you'll have some package tour or something like that at the destination. I think this sounds like a lot of fun. I think it's very clever, and I would imagine that these will sell out very, very quickly.
I've done this sort of. In the 80s, Deutsche Bahn, the German rail system, would have, they called it Fasching in the Blau, which really worked into partying out of the blue. And all they would tell you is when the train was going to be in your town. And you bought a ticket for it. And it was during Fasching, which is Mardi Gras carnival. And you would get on the train and it would take you somewhere. And then there'd be a party. And then at the end of the party, you'd get back on the train and they'd kind of unscrew that nut. And you'd end up back at where your home station was. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was just like, where are we going? Have no clue. What are we going to do? Don't know. Yeah, well, what are we doing? We're just getting on the train.
Well, are you taking your warm clothes or are you taking your cold clothes, right? I mean, how do you pack for something like that?
Well, you're only there for a day or actually for a couple of hours.
But apparently Qantas is giving passengers clues in advance. They're not saying where you're going, but they're giving clues about the destination so you know what clothes you should wear, what you should pack, or at least with a little, a little bit more information. But
afraid if they say, bring your parachute.
Yeah. No.
And Launchpad, I've got to ask you, Fasching, as I recall, is that in February? Is that also kind of known as Carnival?
Fasching starts on mid-November and goes all the way to Lent. So Carnival is shorter. Carnival's about 3 weeks. And, of course, Mardi Gras is only 4 days. But they all end on Ash Wednesday.
Basically, you get to party all winter long.
Right. And, literally, and in Germany, Rosenmontag is – it's not Fat Tuesday. Rosenmontag is the big day because you go out and party like there's no tomorrow on Rosenmontag because you need to sober up all Tuesday because Wednesday you got to go to church.
Okay. That would be Mittwoch.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. One other aspect of this this Qantas little thing here is that, of course, international travel in and out of Australia is really limited right now, and that's hurting the tourism locations. So these three destinations are all inside in Australia somewhere. And Qantas says that besides being fun and all, that these flights are also designed to help promote tourism in parts of the country that, have been really impacted by the coronavirus and the loss of visitors. So it's got that additional benefit. All right. We have a positive airline story of the week.
Yay!
Where did this come from?
I found it kind of randomly, but I thought, wow, this is really kind of cool. And it's Southwest Airlines, which we've given lots of kudos to in the past for various things. And they have just announced that they're going to be donating $3 million worth of plane tickets to provide 7,500 round trips to those people who are in need of urgent medical care. And they don't really get specific in terms of, who and what and, who qualifies and so on. But I'm sure there are many people that probably be able to take advantage of this. And there are other, organizations, for example, that are specifically dedicated to this kind of thing. For example, in general aviation, we have Angel Flight and various other versions of that around the country where pilots will volunteer to take ambulatory patients, people who can climb in and out of airplanes, to their appointments in far-off cities. I've done that in the past for a heart transplant patient who needed to come back to Stanford every 3 months to get checked up. And they mentioned that they've, over the years, I guess, donated $39 million and provided free travel to 9,600 patients and caregivers. And I guess they've got a list of participating groups, 26 states that can help administer these grants for people that might need a free plane ticket.
And that last part is key, because when I first saw the article, my initial thought was, how is Southwest going to decide who could benefit from this? You know, how are they going to do that? And Southwest doesn't make that decision, because what happens here is Southwest makes grants to these nonprofit hospitals and these medical transportation organizations like Angel Flight and so forth, who already do that, and they have that responsibility under this. But this program is called the Medical Transportation Grant Program. And yeah, it's been operating since 2007. And as you said, Max, almost $40 million in free transportation so far. So if you look at the website for this, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes, it actually lists out the hospitals and medical transportation organizations that were selected under this program for this year. But I just think this is a great thing for Southwest to be doing.
I wonder if they're going to use like Angel Flight's vetting system, and maybe they'll even grant Angel Flight.
Well, that's how it works. They grant Angel Flight, for example, money, a certain amount, and then Angel Flight makes the determination of who is eligible.
Yeah, because Angel Flight's really good at and has the experience at vetting and knows how to do all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are a lot of these kinds of organizations. And if you want to find a list of some of the many organizations that perform these kinds of functions, you want to take a look at Air Care Alliance.
Yes.
And I think that's aircarealliance.org. And that's kind of a listing or an organization that, you know, brings all of these organizations under one coordinating umbrella.
Again, we're speaking with Dave Hall from MotoArt, and the website is motoart.com. Dave, can you tell us about the kinds of products that we're talking about here? What are the things that you are creating?
Well, we started MotoArt back in 2001, and the whole thought of it was to try to preserve aviation history. And as you look around, a lot of the aircraft that we kind of grew up with are vastly disappearing. Like when I started, you know, I'd go to Mojave Desert and there'd be a ton of L-1011s sitting there. And so now today there's no L-1011s left. So when we started out, we would go to the boneyard. In fact, people would like laugh at us trying to get in the gate and you're going to do what? Make furniture. And that's exactly what we were set out to do. We were going to get some engine cowlings and some rear stabilizers and galley carts. And we were going to try to come out with a furniture line to, you know, try to preserve some of this aviation history and kind of give it a second life.
And so you produce things like tables of different types, conference tables, coffee
yes.
tables.
Yeah. Desks. I'm sorry. Yeah. So we do a lot of conference tables, wing desk, engine cowlings into bars and reception desks, credenzas, coffee tables, beds. If you ever truly want a mile-high bed, we can build you one. you know, to date, we've done just dozens and dozens of different designs. When we go out to the boneyard, we try to find things that that we'll have multiples of, so we're not doing just a one-off. You know, of course, like the windows out of a Boeing 747. Obviously, you have a lot of windows to work with. So, you know, come out with couches and coffee tables and desks, all made from the windows from the different aircraft that we're tearing apart.
So we got to stop you right there. You can't just say the word mile high bed and not give us some explanation. And by the way, I did go onto the website here, and this doesn't look like it's going to fit into an airplane.
Yeah. Well, you know, we came out with the mile high bed. We had so many people asking us for it. And when we first started the company, you know, we were here with two guys who had absolutely no money, but just this great idea. And what we found was the publicity. Every time we came out with a new design, you know, back then, print magazine was all the rage. I mean, that's where everyone was doing their promotions and advertising. So every time we would do a new piece, we'd professionally photograph it and we'd send it out to The Wire, and people like Maxim or Playboy or Men's Journal or Architectural Digest, they were all writing about it. And we just considered it kind of being like eye candy. And getting back to that Mile High bed, it, you know, so many people asked us for it. So finally, we just went ahead and did a couple designs, and we certainly got a lot of publicity out of it.
And tell us a little bit about the customers. I imagine you have a lot of corporate customers for these kinds of items.
Yeah, and the corporate people are not buying the Mile High beds.
Oh, good.
Yeah, no, that's really the primary of our business is we cater to large corporations, mostly the conference tables and reception areas. You know, I'd be the first to tell you, some of our pieces have so many hours that go into it that I couldn't even afford it, you know. So really the clients are really self-made men, CEOs, or corporations where they'll have budgets for this type of furniture. So we always say nothing's more impressive than walking into a big boardroom and having a huge, beautiful wing conference table there. And it really kind of breaks the ice and gets people talking. And it's really a great setting for these pieces to be in. So, yeah, that's really who our customers mostly are these days.
And when you go to your website, one of the things that struck me is that these aren't small pieces of furniture. That's what really surprised, like, oh, I really want one of these. Then you realize that a conference table that's the engine inlet fan for a J58 or something is 6 or 8 feet in diameter.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The front cowling off of a 7.4 or of an L1011 inlet is, you know, 12 feet in diameter. Is, you know, in my previous civilian life of building conference rooms for technology, that's a big table.
It is. You know, the 747 cowling, we made a really beautiful conference table out of those. And it actually made Ripley's, believe it or not, for the most unique conference table one time. And the 747 cowling is about 105-inch diameter. Then you add the glass on top of that. So, yeah, it's a very massive piece of furniture. And then you got to remember, you got to get it in the building. So when you're constructing these things, you got to really think, okay, how are we getting this in the front door and up to the, you know, the 10th floor? So everything's got to be able to be taken apart and put back together again. So it definitely is a lot of work.
Well, and shipping is a big issue as well, I'm sure. And I really like how you figured out how you can take that big engine and just hang it on the fifth pylon of a 747 to fly it off to your customers.
Right. You know, go ahead, Launchpad.
Well, I was going to say the other thing is that one of the up in Dallas, blah, 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 one of the members of the Confederate Air Force has a Pratt & Whitney 9-cylinder radial coffee table, which is a, you know, coffee table made out of a 9-cylinder engine. And even though it's got the innards removed from it, the pistons and that stuff, that thing still weighs, you know, 500, you know, you have a coffee table that weighs 500 pounds.
Yeah. Trying to move it around. And you're right. The logistics of it all is a whole nother price ticket. You know, I always say, you know, even getting it to our shop before we start working on it is a huge logistics situation. You know, we're buying material out of Roswell, Mojave, Victorville, Marana. And so, you know, we always say even before we pick up a tool, we're into it for a couple $1,000s. We haven't even touched it yet, you know, just, you know, by getting it here. And then, of course, all the man hours goes into it. And then, of course, trying to get to the client safely.
How much of your work is you thinking, wow, this is a neat idea, let's build it, versus how much of this is a customer contacting you and saying, hey, could you make a conference table out of a wing of this?
Right. We get a lot of that request. We try to push everyone in the direction we want them to go. You know, of course, like working with the one time, the DC-9s, you know, all the DC-9s were coming off the line. So we had, you know, lots of rear stabilizers to work with. Now, of course, the MD-80s. Versus the 747s, the large nacelles and cowlings that we're working with. So we really try to push them in the direction that we want to go. And also, you know, we have vintage aircraft, which is always a gray area of, you know, working with more of a vintage aircraft, which has the skeletal airframe versus the all aluminum skin, frame that you'll find in a commercial aircraft.
Well, speaking of the vintage aircraft, I'm sure there's some who are listening to this who are thinking, do you really want to be cutting up this stuff? It should be in a museum instead. And how do you respond to that?
Well, a lot of the vintage aircraft that we work with, the stuff that's never really been restored, like the C-119 flying boxcar, you know, we had tons of airframes from that, or the Grumman Albatross, where, you know, literally we have dozens and dozens of airframes that will never go back on the aircraft. And then sometimes we do. We get lucky enough that we will find someone who has needs something that we might have in our inventory, and we sell it right back into the industry. Like a DC-3 rudder that we might have laying around or something from the B-25. But most of the pieces that we work with are deemed unusable. I mean, there's just no way they're going to go back on the aircraft unless it goes onto a static display. And I got to tell you, a lot of the museums are the ones who are actually giving us these pieces to work with. So it's kind of a win-win situation with what we're working with.
What's the most unique project you've worked on in your mind?
Unique project. God, we've had so many of them. It's been 20 years. The ones I'm most proud of, we did the San Luis Obispo County Airport a few years ago, where we did a main wall mount display of a Gulfstream G2 and a 747 Cowling reception desk. We've done a beautiful watch display for Rolex, made also out of a 747. And then also, it's always a thrill to be able to work with the aerospace companies, with like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Boeing, to build, custom projects for them.
Tell us about your tell us what Delta asked you to do. That's kind of different.
Well, this is definitely a project that I'm proud of. Back, I guess about 4 years ago on Christmas Eve, I got an email from Delta Airlines and it just says hot on it. And I'm like, what is this? It's Christmas Eve. And I open it up and it says, hey, we really love the plane tags that you guys do, but can you do a puzzle piece? And, I'm quick to reply, yeah, of course we can do a puzzle piece. They said, well, can you make 92,500 of them in 6 weeks and have them all interconnecting? And it just kind of stopped.
Not the same puzzle piece. They wanted you to make a massive puzzle that had 96,000 pieces to it.
In 6 weeks and have it in Atlanta for the profit sharing program. So, of course, I just sit there and be like, yeah, of course, not really knowing how we're going to do it. And so we kind of canceled all of our Christmas plans and away we went. We worked with Delta on dismantling a 747 in Marana, and they were just shipping us truckloads of material like every day. And we were taking it apart and stamping it out. We got some dies, of course, for the stamp machines, and we pulled it off. It was basically a 45-foot long by 24-foot wide puzzle that went together at their corporate headquarters, and they went out there and had the big celebration, and every piece of the puzzle represented an employee at Delta Airlines. So anyone who worked at Delta got one of those little puzzle pieces. So that was a pretty fantastic job and very quick. I was just shocked that we pulled it off.
I'm just picturing the party where everybody had to, you had that giant cardboard box that came in, you dumped it all out on the floor and you had to go through and turn all the pieces so they were right side up.
Right.
Dave, if someone walks into your shop, what do they see?
Well, we have a pretty colorful shop. When you first walk in, like I'm sitting in my office right now, the wall is covered with different artifacts from aircraft. I got a B-52 cowling. I got a couple F-86 cowlings, an old circular staircase from a 747-100. I got a practice drone hanging above my head, some cargo flooring on the wall.
Oh, cut that thing up.
And then when you walk into the shop, we're pretty clean and organized here. We have some old artifacts hanging from the ceilings and then different bays. We have two metal fabrication bays, a wood bay, and then we have the sanding and polishing shop next door. I try to keep it all separated because it's pretty dirty in the sanding and polishing shop. But I invite anyone to come by. We're located in Torrance, and it's definitely a little bit like a museum when you walk in the front doors here.
I imagine. What about the employees? What kinds of skill sets do they have?
And how many?
Yeah, well, truly, my employees are the true artists. You know, it's funny, if I walk out there and try to work on something, then they all laugh at me at this point. So I, you know, we, the metal fabricators, the wood guys, I mean, most of my employees have been here for 10 plus years already. And it's really kind of just a big family here. So employee wise, we got about 20, 22 employees at any given time.
Now you've got the big desks that are just so impressive. And I mean, I've seen a cowling desk at Airplane Museum, Pima Air Museum, and it's huge. You know, actually two people sit behind this desk. It's that big because it's a 747 engine cowling. But you also make plane tags. Talk to us about plane tags.
Right. You know, the whole time I had Moto Art, you know, we were making this big, impressive pieces for exhibits and furniture. And I kept going, look, we got to come out with that $25 item. We're just getting killed here with these high prices with what we're trying to sell. And one day, probably around 2006, 2007, early in our years, we were working with a P-51 Mustang. Somebody dropped off an air scoop that was smashed up and wanted to do something with it. And we never really did work with that P-51, but we had the metal from it. And I said, well, hey, wouldn't it be cool to kind of maybe come up with like a little tag from that? I mean, what else can we do with it? So I cut myself a little oval piece of metal from that P-51 skin, and I laser
etched. You cut up a P-51?
it was deemed to be thrown away. So I made myself this little tag, and it, I kid you not, sat in my pocket for years and years and years, and it wasn't until about 2015 that for Black Friday, I bought myself an old stamp machine, and I stamped out four different airplanes, and I came out with the first series of plane tags. And it just exploded on us. You know, for all these years, we had these people following us with all of our furniture. And all of a sudden, boom, I came out with that $25 item. And it was just like that. You ever seen that internet commercial? It was like ding, 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 ding. Yeah. That's exactly what happened with our shopping cart on the first Black Friday. So I knew we had something at that moment. And it's really kind of just changed our whole, you know, livelihood here a little bit. You know, we separated the companies. Now we have Moto Art that does the exhibit and the furniture. And then we have plane tags. And plane tags now, we're coming out with two different aircraft a month. And we've done about 100 different planes. And we have enough for the next 3 years right now to continue doing two a month and have a pretty good following for what we're doing. And I see it as an educational platform. You know, I always say no one learns more about these planes than I do. You know, working with these different aircraft, you know, I don't know everything about the Starship and the 707. But when you start working with them, you really start learning a lot, especially when you're cutting them up. It's kind of what we call reverse engineering.
Dave, tell us what your latest two, and this month, what are the two aircraft you got? Or two tags you got?
Last week we came out with our general aviation. It was one of the things that we're missing out of all these aircraft. I mean, we're doing the B-17s and the C-130s and the 747s, but we never had anything from the GA. So we came out with a Cessna 172 and the Beechcraft, a Bonanza. So we were excited about those, and they made a big splash. We debuted them last week and sold probably about 1,000 tags in the first week. So wow. It was a success.
These are great. Looks like they're numbered and you've got the tail number on them. So there's actually some traceable history associated with the tags.
Right. You go to Google and you type it in and you find out everything you need to know about the aircraft. But in the horizon, I mean, we've got some great planes coming up. We've got the Starship, Beechcraft Starship coming up. We got a Boeing 707 coming up. And just today, I bought a North American F-100 Super Saber. So I'm excited about that. That goes in the queue for a future release.
Well, to our listeners, the thing being is the tag has the serial number of the tag. Then it has the actual serial number of the aircraft. And then on the sale card, which is like a baseball trading card, it gives you the history of that model of airplane. Then it actually says the history of that aircraft, right, which is pretty impressive. And, oh, by the way, we just kind of looked up on eBay today, popped up, is a P-51. Two things I want to say is a P-51 plane tag. You cut up a P-51? But the P-51 tag on eBay is the guy's asking $2,400 for it.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
because it was a limited run of, I can't see on the.
Don't tell Dave that. He's gonna raise the price above that $25.
You know, I sold that one for $50, I think.
It already says, it just popped up again. I went and searched. Says sold.
Sold. There you go.
I got it.
I got to thank my brother for that one. I'm kidding. No, that's what's great about the plane tags is it has such an aftermarket to it, and it's fun to follow these guys. They have a fan club set up on Facebook for people collecting them. They trade them and they sell them, and it's been real fun to watch the whole aftermarket of these things take off. You know, and we're not gouging prices. We try to keep everything at a reasonable price, and I'm excited to see that some of these tags are really kind of going up in value. So I'm proud of that.
And these can be used for or as luggage tags or a variety of different purposes, I guess.
Yeah, we advertise them for luggage tags or for your keychains. But really, what everyone's doing, the people who are buying them are mostly just displaying them at this point. We, you know, we make racks, and a lot of the people who have plane tags usually have, you know, probably more than 10 of them. People are really starting to get into collecting them. So I can't tell you how many times every day, we get people emails like, hey, I threw away that card that came with the tag because I realized the card was part of the package, you know, that talked about the history of the aircraft. So we always encourage people to keep their cards.
And when you read the card, one of my favorite parts of authenticity, and it says, caution, not recommended for children under 8. Do not suck on card or allow to be put in mouth. Contains original paint, which may not be, you know, yeah, it's got the original Z-Bart on it, which, you know, wasn't designed to be, you know, lead-based and probably got some other chemicals on it that, you know.
Yeah, please don't suck on them.
Yeah, I love the fact, you know, because it's like, you know, contains original paint.
Right. I mean, it is what it is. Look, it's a piece of an aircraft fuselage that we've stamped out with the original paint on it. I mean, look, we do a lot of contracts with a lot of major airlines. I mean, we work with British Airways, United, Delta, American, Allegiant, Virgin, and they all have different requirements. You know, sometimes we remove everything. You know, we'll remove all the paint and just give them a blank aluminum card with a laser etched on it. Takes a little bit of the romance away, but, you know, we still offer that to our clients.
Well, I want to get into what we've got for them is that we've raised our geeks are out there all drooling now, wishing they could have one of these things. Well, there's two ways you can do that. One is for the furniture, MotoArt, in conjunction with the Pima Air Museum, is having a raffle for a... Is it a, I forget what kind of P, it's a tail section of a 737, isn't it?
Well, I think what they're doing is they're offering a gift card at MotoArt where you could spend it how you want. I think they posted some different photographs up, but, you know, that's really for a good cause. They're trying to raise money for a new hangar out there. So we're trying to do our part and, you know, Pima's been real good to us, throughout the years, and we're trying to do our part to make sure they get what they need out there as well.
Pima is an amazing museum. I was trying to remember how long it's been since I was there. And it's probably like 15 or 20 years, maybe even 20, I guess. And so maybe it's a lot – it's even better now maybe than it was because I think the Pima Air Museum is one of those places that should be on everybody's bucket list. It's just an amazing facility.
Pima Air Museum is a friend of the podcast because if you remember back in episode insert correct episode number here. we went out there and they even donated some books to our listeners. And now they're having this raffle for this desk. And guys, this desk is going to be worth about $25,000. It's a huge desk. But now that's not the only thing we're going to give away here.
Well, wait a minute. Now, before we get into that, we should also mention that this sweepstakes with the Pima Air and Space Museum is open through April 9th. And so that's going to come up pretty quickly. And we'll have a link in the show notes if you'd like to take a look at that. But let's see if I can do it. It's pimaair.org/win-25K. So it's pimaair.org/win-25K. But we'll have that in the show notes.
If you go to the website, there'll be a little link right up top, too, that you can click on.
That's probably
take you right there, right?
Yeah. It's nice when you see a company, because museums, of course, have been really suffering in the over the course of the past year in terms of just a huge loss of revenue. And so for a company to offer something like this to help support the museum, I think is great. That's just fantastic.
Right, and it couldn't go to a better museum than Pima. They're just really a great place to visit if you haven't been there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to try to get out that direction this summer, and I'd be more than happy to make a repeat visit there.
And Maxwell, I was also going to tell you, I set up, before I jumped on this podcast, I set up a discount code for your listeners if they want to go to plaintags.com. Oh. And if they just type in Airplane Geeks in the, the darn discount code, it'll be an automatic 15% off on their first purchase. So
thank you.
Yeah, certainly jump on that.
Thank you. That's very kind, because these things would make great gifts too. I mean, love to have one yourself, but if you know, an enthusiast or an av geek, I'm sure that they would love to receive something like this. Now, we seem to have lost Launchpad. I don't know where he's gone, but what he started to say is that in addition to a discount code for purchasing them, which is just amazing. I wasn't expecting that. We have a giveaway, a plane tag giveaway. And if you'd like to try for one of these tags, it's very simple. What we'll ask you to do is send a picture or a screen grab of your favorite Moto Art furniture or plane tag. Just visit the website, motoart.com. Find the item there that maybe would be your dream item, and clip that or take a screenshot and email that to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com and use the subject plane tags so we can find it easily. And we'll have a drawing. Launchpad, you're back with us. So we have four.
Okay, we've got four tags that Dave has super graciously donated to us. We've got a Boeing 747. This is one of the 747-100. So this is like the first 747, and it's only run by TWA, or it only lived for TWA. And we've got that. We have a UH-1F Iroquois helicopter that was run by the Air Force, and we've got the history of that one. The next one up, we have a P-51K. You cut up a P-51?
I knew that was coming.
I did too. Yeah.
But it's even got the rivet holes in it and the original Z-Bark paint. Don't suck on it, kids.
Yep.
But it's off of a P-51. And in fact, we can even tell you P-51 serial number. I can see it 44-12852. So it's a real one. And then the big one that I really think I should have won, but I got to give it away. It's off of a Messerschmitt BF-109.
Mm, very cool. Very cool.
Which has the tag, and it's actually got the history of this aircraft and where it went to. And after the war, it ended up in Bulgaria, then ended up in Yugoslavia, flying for the, and you know. So we've got those four tags.
Is a BF-109 the same thing as an ME-109?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
That's the actual, the BF-109 is actually the German designation for it.
So I'd like to get the 109 and the P-51, and I'm going to have those tags fight each other, and we'll just see which plane tag comes out on top. Hey, tell us, how big are these? And I know that they're great for putting on your luggage or attaching your keys to. What's the size of a plane tag?
They're about 3 inch in length. It's an oval. And then also on the backside, we leave an area there where you can actually put your name and address on it. Or if you go to plaintags.com, there's actually a customization section where you can actually, for a small fee, put your name in it and address, and we'll laser it right onto the tag itself.
Very cool.
Yeah. Now, Launchpad, before you tear into me about this P-51, I got to tell you how we come up with this skin, because that's the first question is, how in the heck did you come up with this P-51 or this BF-109? And it's a real simple answer. These old guys are working on the restorations of these aircraft, you know, unlike cars where you, you know, you Bondo it, paint over it again, a lot of this old aircraft, they're removing these authentic skins and putting new aluminum skins on them. And so what they do is they'll take the skins off, they'll use it as a pattern, and then make a new aluminum skins for it. So a lot of these guys, I mean, did just exactly what I thought they'd do. They don't throw away these old patterns. So anytime that we're working with someone or a museum or something like that, that they're working some of this aircraft, the first thing they say is, oh, yeah, I kept all those skins. And you go in the back and sure as heck, they have all these old patterns that they had taken off the aircraft. And that's how we're able to work with some of these skins.
Ah, okay. That makes a lot of sense. Launch pad. So we have four of these. So we're going to do four drawings. Is that
correct? And if you haven't, while I was gone, my internet collapsed. While you're gone, also, when they send their entry in, rank which one you want, because if you're the first one drawn, you'll get your first choice. If you're, you know,
okay.
So put them in rank order.
All right.
Of which ones you'd get so that you can get the one you want or the second one you want or, you know.
So say again, Launchpad, what the four are.
The four are a BF-109, Messerschmitt 109, a P-51K, a UH-1F, owned by the Air Force, and a 747.
Very good.
And we'll have the picture for that on the website. In the show notes, and we'll also have a link if you want to buy a raffle ticket to win a $25,000 desk. Yeah,
and that goes to a really good cause as well. So I encourage everyone to go to the Pima website and buy a raffle ticket, and let's try to raise those guys as much money as we can.
And Dave, I want to thank you again for donating these four tags to us. This was awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's big. That's very nice. And we'll be accepting your entries for the giveaway through March 31st, 2021. And we'll announce the winners in April. But get them into us by end of March. We're very excited about this. I wish I could enter. Well, I'm going to have to buy one. I'm going to have to buy my own, which is what I'm going to do.
Now they got the discount code.
Now they have the discount code. All right. Dave, to sort of wrap it up, so you've been doing this for a while. You've been, I don't know. So are you, is it a glorified dumpster diving kind of a job? I mean, is that basically what you're, and what have you seen change over the years that you've been doing this?
Glorified dumpster, you know, maybe a little bit. You know, I still get so tickled pink every time I go out to the boneyard and just think how lucky I am to be able to do what we do. You know, and what I've seen change, of course, as I said earlier in the program, a lot of the aircraft that we first started with 20 years ago are gone. And the same is happening with, you know, the DC-9s, and now the 747s are taking and retiring them all. And there's really no room for these out there. So what they're doing is they're quickly dismantling them to make room for more planes coming in. So I'm happy to do what we're doing and try to give them a second life and keep the story alive.
Outstanding. Well, we want to thank you again, Dave Hall, motoart.com. The tags website, you have a separate website for that?
Yeah, plaintags.com.
Great.
Gentlemen, thank you. It was fun to sit there and listen to you guys, and I'm glad I made it through, and thank you for not ripping into me too much.
No. Yeah, we're happy to have you. Thanks so much for that discount code as well as the four plane tags that we can give away to our listeners. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, gentlemen.
What's up with the geeks? Let's see. Am I the only one who's got something this episode, Max Trescott, you're not doing any aviating these days? No, he's nodding his, shaking his head no. Launchpad, anything aviation-wise?
I've got a couple of restaurant reviews for Eat at the Airports. Been out discovering and adding new Eat at the Airports. Went out to a really cool one down in Uvalde, Texas, and we'll have that coming in.
Good, good.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah, we have the website, eatattheairport.com, and it's a graphical map of the world, because there are all over the world, but it's eating establishments located at airports. And so, you know, it's been kind of a bit slow in the last year with COVID and going out to eat. But the idea is that if you're at or near an airport, a lot of them are GA airports or smaller regional airports. There's some really nice eating establishments often at those airports, and you can find one to patronize. I've actually used it on road trips where I'm driving through a state, and I'll look and see, well, am I going to be going past any kind of an airport? And if I am, if there's a diner there or some place that people have enjoyed eating, you know, I'll stop there and eat. Why not, right?
And don't be discouraged that they're by a general aviation airports. For instance, while we were down in Uvalde, a Navy T-6 and an Air Force T-6 landed in there for students doing their cross country. And they're like, gee, we got to go somewhere. Hey, there's this great restaurant at this little GA airport. So they landed, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, a lot of times, especially if these restaurants or diners or whatever are actually on the airport property, they're usually facing the runway with windows, and so you can, you know, watch the planes as you have your lunch or whatever. I'll mention again avgeekfests.com, our aviation calendar of events. We've loaded in a bunch of webinars coming up in the next month or so. Of course, most but not all of the aviation events in the short term here are online or webinars or, you know, that kind of a thing. So there's a bunch of new ones in there. Have a look at avgeekfests.com. Also, we've had some questions about the annual Innovations in Flight Family Day and Outdoor Aviation Display that's held annually at the Udvar-Hazy Center, part of the National Air and Space Museum. And I checked the website just a day or two ago, and it says planning is underway for the next Innovations of Flight. Check back soon for more information. So I think we're not sure what their plans are. Launchpad is vibrating.
I am so psyched to do this. I'm going to, you know, that's one of my big summer vacations. Usually it's kind of sort of around Father's Day. I'm going to fly out there all the way out, go through all the paperwork. Can't wait to display the air, you know, to say, you know, oh, my airplane, to fly into Udvar-Hazy and meet all our fans and do a live. This is like, I am so biting at the bit to be there.
Yeah, you'd be flying into Dulles and then taxiing over to the museum adjacent. Yeah. Another event coming up is Sun and Fun, the Sun and Fun Aerospace Expo. That's April 13th through 18th. 2021. Their website is flysnf.org, and that's still on the schedule right now for a in-person event.
And folks, mark that on your calendar, even if you're not going to be there, because the Airplane Geeks will be live Wednesday, April 14th at 1800 hours. That's 6 p.m. on that's Wednesday. We will be live on Sun and Fun Radio, and you can hear it also recast on liveatc.net, and then we'll put it out later, so that'll be a delayed broadcast, but we'll be live. If you're there, come by and see us. I'll probably have some German chocolate for you.
Yeah. So I guess the headline, the FastJet demonstration is from the U.S. Navy Blue Angels. And
you said that wrong. We're the headline.
Okay.
They're the opening act.
They're the opening act. And yeah, they're going to be flying for the first time, or their first performance appearance in the new Super Hornets. So that will be exciting. Now, of course, a big issue is COVID, right? And we'll put a link in the show notes to the Sun and Fun page with the COVID policy. They've actually created a review committee to look at what the protocols are going to be. And on that webpage, which may be updated or could be updated, you'll find the latest. But as of right now, they're going to require masks in all areas where social distancing isn't possible, although people will be encouraged to wear masks in all open-air locations. They're also going to limit daily ticket sales. I don't know by how much. and they're going to expand some of the areas where, you know, in the past there have been large congregations of people. All the indoor exhibitors will be required to wear masks. Anybody entering the hangars or other enclosed exhibit areas will be required to wear masks. And there are a number of other things that they're implementing. The eating locations will be or will have social distance seating, undergo continuous wipe down procedures, as well as overnight long-term disinfecting taking place. Same for all the permanent bathrooms and portable shower houses. We'll have attendants in place, and they'll be sanitizing on an ongoing basis. So, again, there are some other things that you can look at. If you're considering going, please take a look at this webpage and make your own decision about if you're going to attend and how you want to do this.
And in another shameless plug I want to put out, on Friday, the Airplane Geeks, UAV Digest, and maybe even Aviation News Talk Radio are just three of the groups that are going to be part of Open Pod Night, where they bring together all of the podcasters to meet, and we all have an open, on a mic, and we do some stuff. This will be our second year of doing it, and third year. And so if you guys know of any other podcasts that you think might be invited that we haven't already, because we were inviting them all, send me a letter at an email at launchpad@theairplanegeeks, because we're putting this together. And that'll be, again, you can get even more of your aviation fix.
Very good. Now, I know that different people have different opinions about what everyone should and should not be doing in this during this pandemic. And some people are not, not happy that there are events, large events these days. And I'm not going to tell anybody, how they should think about it or what they should do or not do. But one thing that I think hopefully everybody can agree on is the tragic consequence of this pandemic in terms of the number of deaths worldwide, not just in the United States, but worldwide. So there's no really good transition from talking about aviation events to our next item. But we recently lost Mike Collins, and Rob Mark wrote and recorded for us, for you, a little bit of information about Mike Collins. So we'll listen to Rob Mark right now.
I think it was Mark Twain who cynically spoke once about lies, damn lies, and statistics to show us how easily lists of numbers can be manipulated to tell some pretty extraordinary stories. And let's face it, lists of numbers can be pretty dry, unless you can add some context, of course. Take the COVID-19 pandemic. If you're someone who trusts numbers, they show the virus has already claimed 2.5 million lives around the world, more than 500,000 here in the U.S. So how do you even get your hands around that? Do you know 2.5 million people? Or even 500,000? I sure as hell don't. But sometimes, it only takes one person for all those numbers to make sense. At least that worked for me when I learned recently that my friend Mike Collins had passed away. At 59, Mike was AOPA Pilot's technical editor and their director of business operations. COVID-19 snatched him away after a couple of really awful weeks in the hospital. Mike was a guy I was proud to call a friend. Not a close buddy-buddy kind of friend, but one of the regular dozen journalists I run into at aviation events around the country. Mike was the kind of guy who'd pick me out of the crowd with a simple, "Hey, Rob," before a quick catch-up session. He was an extraordinary photographer as well as an adventurer, like when he sat right seat in Mike Laver's MU-2 for a trip around the world. In over 30 or 40 hours of flying, he never missed feeding photos and videos back to the AOPA mothership for the rest of us to enjoy. AOPA Pilot's editor-in-chief Tom Haines said, "If you've ever held a copy of AOPA Pilot or Flight Training Magazine in your hands over the past 29 years, you've benefited from Mike's work." In a look back at Mike's career, Haynes said he learned the biz as a newspaper guy in North Carolina before becoming editor of the Southern Aviator. Tom said, I knew I could toss any assignment Mike's way, and he'd figure out how to bring back a terrific story, almost always with a human angle to it. Now me? I also love Mike's incredible knack for translating technobabble into really great stories. Early on, he learned how to blend his already impressive video skills with the latest drone platforms. He was also an early podcaster and even a beer maker. Why doesn't that surprise me? Mike once said, photojournalism is all about storytelling, and aviation is full of great stories just waiting to be told. Here's one Mike moment I remember. I was writing a story for AOPA Pilot some years ago about checking out in the L-39 jet. Magazine sent Mike Collins to Chicago to handle the photos while I flew the jet. We arranged to use a restored SNJ with a back seat aimed rearward to become Mike's photo platform. There was just one little problem. The flight came together in the middle of January, so Mike was dressed like he was headed for the North Pole. Now think about the wind chill with an outside air temperature of 10 Fahrenheit and a wind of 135 miles an hour. In tight formation for the air-to-airs, I could see the fur on his big parka flapping wildly in the breeze. So I squeezed the mic button. Hey, Mike, you keeping warm over there? I'm freezing my butt off. Then silence. After we landed the L-39, I was feeling really guilty having spent a couple of hours in a nice warm cockpit while I assumed Mike was freezing in the SNJ. Are you starting to defrost, Mike? I said as I approached. He never even flinched. Oh, sure. That was a blast. Let's go do it again. That was Mike. Mike Collins left behind his wife, Jeanette Prince, as well as two daughters and a son. You can check out Flying a Real Jet to Make Like Maverick at AOPA.org, and you'll also have a chance to see some of the awesome photos Mike shot. For the full scoop on Mike's career, click on Saying Goodbye at AOPA.org as well. You'll find a list of organizations there where you can make a donation in Mike's honor. We're all going to miss you, Mike. From Chicago, this is Rob Mark for Jetwine.com and the Airplane Geeks.
Nicely done. Nicely done. Thank you, Rob.
And one other thing I'll just mention is that there's yet another editor at AOPA who has been laid up for over a month now with COVID and is just now starting to see some normal oxygen readings. He posted on his personal Facebook page that he's finally up to a 97% on the oximeter. So, yeah, this has had a huge impact on many, many people.
Yeah, it sure has. Well, again, want to thank Rob for that. Rob was recently on the Podcasting on a Plane podcast. It's episode 91. You might look for that and get some more of your Rob Mark fix. All right, one item. Just wanted to reiterate the poll from last episode, the listener poll. Our question is, who would you like to see win the 2020 Collier Trophy? And we want to thank those of you who have already responded to that. It's very quick, very simple. It's just one click, kind of a poll. We don't collect email addresses or anything like that. And you can find that at airplanegeeks.com/poll. 643, because it comes from episode 643, and we'll have a list of all the nominees for the Collier Trophy and ask you to tick the one that you'd like to see win. We're using this system here, Riverside.fm. We've been using that for a few weeks now to record these podcasts, and one of the features of it is that we get to see a video of each of the folks who are on. So we can see Max Trescott and Launchpad and Dave Hall. Well, earlier there seemed to be a flurry of cats. Now, I don't have a cat, but I think each of the three of you held up your cats.
Or had it march across the desk while we were trying to talk. We've been kind of feline interruptus.
Yeah, mine hit the microphone as I was talking at one point. She had been asleep when I started. I didn't want to throw her out, but I have since thrown her out.
Dave, you have a cat also.
Yeah, his nickname is Boneyard Louie. So
that's appropriate.
He's a shop cat here, so he kills all the mice and keeps Modo Art at bay.
Fantastic. Now, I don't have a cat. I've had cats in the past, but none now. But the reason it's kind of relevant, and you all are probably wondering why we're talking about cats, actually, is Micah sent in an item to us. This is from the CashmereWalla.com. Cat attacks pilots in cockpit, plane forced to make emergency landing. So this was a Sudanese flight. And apparently about 30 minutes after departing from Khartoum International Airport, headed for Doha, a cat got into the cockpit. And it started attacking.
A feral cat.
And it started – right, not someone's pet cat apparently. And it started attacking the pilots.
Oh, no.
Well, they weren't able to control the cat, so the pilot decided to turn around and make an emergency landing. So they don't really know for sure how the cat got on the plane, but I think they speculate maybe when it was in the hangar or something for maintenance or some reason it got itself onto the plane.
I wonder what the transponder emergency code is for I'm being attacked by a cat.
Attacked by a cat. Yeah, cats don't like so this isn't the first time that cats have caused mayhem on an airplane. Apparently in 2004, a cat got into the cockpit of a Belgian airline. Maybe that was Sabena. I'm not sure. But it had to return to Brussels as a result. And there was another flight where a stowaway cat entered the cockpit. This was a flight in Bangladesh, and the cat attacked the pilot in that case. Now, one thing that's missing from all this reporting is what happened to these cats, right? It doesn't tell us what happened to the cat.
I'm thinking the pilot didn't adopt the nice kitty.
Probably not.
I'm just amazed you had a cat story ready to go.
I know. Well, Mike also sent in an item from the Press Herald. Trade Group names Portland's Jetport best in North America. So Airports Council International, each year they have an annual Airport Service Quality Awards, the ASQ Awards, and they recognize the world's best airports in customer experience. And so how do they pick these airports? Well, they use two surveys. There's a departure survey and an arrivals survey that's used to determine who the winners are in these different categories. This year, Amadeus sponsored the awards. Amadeus, of course, is a global travel technology company. But the Portland International Jetport was named Best Airport in North America for customer experience in its passenger class. That passenger class is between 2 and 5 million passengers annually. And, of course, congratulations to the entire team there, to Paul Bradbury, the Jetport manager. And Paul's been on the podcast once or twice. Separately, we got a press release that Prague Airport received the 2020 Airport Service Quality Award. They're in the category of 15 to 25 million passengers. But, you know, I tried to find out from the ACI, the Airports Council International website, who are all the winners? Where's the list of winners? And I couldn't find it. I could find the previous year, so maybe I just looked too soon. They haven't put them up there. Because I'd like to sort of see, you know, who else won? Who are the others?
I vote we assign that to Micah because he's not here to object.
All right, Micah, there's your task. Do a little homework. All right, a little bit of listener mail. Paul sent us an email. He said, look at the combined ages of these four Boeings flying near me at the same time. And these are from, where were these from? Flight Radar 24, I think, some screenshots. But anyway, four KC-135R Strato tankers in his area all at the same time. One is 59 years old, one is 60 years old, another one is 60 years old, and the fourth one was 58 years old. So, boy, there's some seriously old aircraft. Dave, have you ever done anything with a KC-135?
No, we haven't. I'm eager to, but one of the things that we have a problem with is we're not really allowed to touch military aircraft. A lot of the laws have changed, and Homeland Security just doesn't want you to have in those parts. So we, only thing that we can really find are the stuff that's really been grandfathered in before all the laws to change.
Ah, I see. All right.
That's kind of strange because the one thing you're doing is demilling them.
I exactly. I mean, I just had this
actually technically, I guess you're milling them.
I just had this conversation today. You cannot demill it any more than we're demilling it with the plane tag. So I don't know if I need someone in there to start lobbying for me or what, but hopefully we'll break that one day.
Dave, do you ever have to, I don't know, notch parts or somehow, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, damage the parts.
Chain of custody?
No, so they right. can't be mistaken for serviceable parts in the future.
We did way back when. I mean, when we first started in 2001, we'd go down to Tucson, and you know they had all the miniature little boneyards set up around Davis-Monthan, and National Aircraft is where we bought a lot of our inventory back in the day, and you know, we bought just a fleet of ejection seats and F4 speed brake doors, and we had to literally go and put big cut marks in every single one of them so they wouldn't go back onto a plane. So to answer your question, yes, we've had to do that, but not recently.
Hmm. Yeah. I remember from my days at Pratt & Whitney that if you had airfoils, for example, that were scrapped, not able to be made serviceable, you had to notch them. So that they could not – you had to notch them in a way that they could not be repaired even if you tried to unscrupulously obtain those parts and try to make them cosmetically look repaired. You couldn't do that. So, yeah, I was just wondering if you'd run across that. All right. We also got an email from Tom. He says, this is a cool site. And this is virtualvacation.us/fly. He says, you click on any city and you'll be on board a jet flying over it and making final approach to landing. Totally feels like you're aboard the plane. I clicked on a few and they are pretty cool. Well, they're sort of major cities, major locations, things like that. This is not like a huge database of, you know, every place you could fly, every airport you could fly into. But, you know, you get to see some great views of the, you know, of the cities and the, you know, surrounding areas and so forth. It's pretty neat. I can imagine checking this out if I was going to be flying into one of these cities to get kind of a preview of, you know, what it might look like. Might help you plan what side of the airplane to be on too, I guess. But thanks for that, Tom. Okay, well, that's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. And we want to thank Dave Hall, co-founder and owner of Motor Art, founder and owner of Motor Art Plane Tags, motorart.com, planetags.com. Don't forget to look for the Pima Air and Space Museum link that we'll have, or just go to Pima Air and Space.
And Max, I have to correct you. It's Moto Art, not Moto Art. Moto Art. There's no R. So it's MOTOART.com.
That's what I tried to say. Did I insert an R in there?
You did. You
oh,
did.
No.
It's pretty common.
Oh no! I didn't do that the whole show, did I?
Nope. Just that time.
Sometimes, yeah. Talk about behind the curtain. Sometimes I will if that. Sometimes I will go back and find like a correct moto and slice out the motor and put the moto in the motor and no one will ever know the difference. But not this time. It's going to stay.
You know why we came out with moto is we wanted to be anyway, it started out being anything like a machine and we kind of just got stuck in aviation and but we wanted to kind of branch out and do all sorts of interesting things when we first came out with that name. So that's why everyone asks us, where did you come up with Moto Art?
Yeah, I thought that was something like that. Yeah, you got stuck in aviation. Once you get stuck in aviation, you never escape from it.
Yeah, it's pretty high flying. It was a place to be.
Yeah, very
why
good.
Would you want to?
I know. Well, that's true. And also, thank you for the discount code, Airplane Geeks. That's good for
15% off.
15% off.
Woohoo!
Yep. Appreciate that greatly. Yeah, that was unexpected. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. We'll have show notes, all the stuff we talked about the links, the other information, be sure to check that out. We have a shortcut that redirects right to the show notes. That's airplanegeeks.com/644, because that's the episode. Don't forget our listener poll. We're looking for you to contribute to that. If you want to reach us by email, we're at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Max Truscott. Do you say Truscott or Truscott?
I do. Yeah, I say Truscott. Though I've also found out that if you go down to that city in Arizona that starts with a P, they tend to, I think, say more Prescott as opposed to Prescott.
Yeah.
So, but I'm not sure everybody agrees on that either. So who knows? Yeah, folks can find me at the usual place, which is the Aviation News Talk podcast. If you want to shoot me an email, just head out to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact at the top of the page.
And Launchpad Marzari.
Well, you can find me on Facebook. I'm Launchpad Marzari. You can find me on Twitter as Pilot Launchpad. Still struggling to figure out Twitter. And you can find me as Launchpad on our Slack listener team. And if you want to join the conversation, all you have to do is send us an email, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, for an invitation, and we'll send you back. And you can be part of our Slack listener group, where we have lots of conversations on different aircraft and even other random things in the randoms department.
That's right.
So give us a ping on our Slack listener group.
It's almost like bonus content, because sometimes, depending on what's going on, we'll put things in there or provide some information in there that doesn't make it to the podcast. Extra photos. I put some information in about the United 777 that had the engine failure and the recent NTSB update on that, which they announced last Friday, I believe. And then promptly for at least 2 days, the NTSB website was down and you couldn't get into it. But it's back up now, so you can find that information on that report. Very interesting. You can find me at 30,000feet.com, all words. Spell it out, and you can learn where I am on social media, all the podcasts I do, and all of that. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Frequency change approved. Good day.
And thank you for listening.